I keep forcing myself to say this. Data beats gut feel by a million miles.
Welcome to Right Around Real Estate, the show about how to passively invest like a pro. On each episode, I interview real estate experts who give their top investing advice, strategies, and tools, and I break down their insights into practical steps to avoid the pitfalls and make better investments. I want to help you passively invest like a pro. This is Right Around Real Estate, and I'm your host, Kent Ritter. Hello, fellow investors. Welcome to another episode of Ritter on Real Estate, where we teach you how to passively invest like a pro. Today, my guest is Neil Bawa. He is the mad scientist of multifamily. I'm sure most of you know Neil and know his brand and his reputation. We're very excited to have you on again, Neil.
Thanks for having me back. It's always great to chat with you. Always great to, to connect with the community.
Yeah. So Neil was originally on episode 38. So make sure you guys go and check that out and get more of his story. And we covered a lot of, about systems in that episode and some of the processes he uses to differentiate their brand and to add value back to their investors. So really great episode. Make sure you check it out. We'll link that below. Today though, Neil, I think as you said so astutely before this call, we're in a very interesting time. And I completely agree with you. I think a lot of people are trying to figure out what to do, right? Whether you're an operator and you're saying, well, should we be buying? Should we be selling? If you're a new syndicator and you're saying, well, is this the right time to jump in? This seems kind of scary with everything that's going on. Or you're an investor and you're saying, where should my money be? Should I be sitting on the sidelines? Is real estate a good idea? How does all this come together? So I think that's how we're going to shape our conversation today, is try to answer some of those questions for folks. First off, I think let's just, for those, if there are folks out there that don't know who you are, let's just give them a quick overview, talk about your background and talk about your company and what you're doing these days.
Absolutely. So I am a technologist, so a geek, a nerd. I'm schooled in the Silicon Valley way of thinking. I've had a successful tech exit, took a company from 10 employees to 400 and sold it, and invested in real estate basically to reduce my taxation. I live in California, so I've got, 50 plus percent taxes each year, and real estate is a fantastic way to, bring my taxation down. So I was doing that for 6 years before I switched over to real estate after my company was sold, and had a blast doing it. And because I'm a data scientist by profession, basically computer science degree, I apply data science to everything that I do. I apply systems and processes and outsourcing to everything that I do. And when I started applying it to real estate, I realized that actually it was more beneficial and more impactful to apply it to real estate than to technology. Because in technology, there's always 10 smarter guys than you, and they automate so fast that you get a 3 month window or a 6 month window. But when you're applying core data science to real estate, you get a window that's, 5 years. And as long as in 5 years you've come up with new and better precepts, you stay ahead. But so what I found was that, technology in real estate actually is better than technology in technology itself. So That's what I've been doing. Pivoted in 2014 to basically go full time in real estate. Been doing it for about 8 years. Currently have about 800 very geeky, very nerdy investors. A lot of them live in Silicon Valley. They're technologists and doctors. And I invest in many asset classes, with multifamily being the core foundation, but not necessarily the biggest asset class that we invest in. We have a core set of concepts and ideas that are very different from a typical syndicator. So we normally actually don't come up in competition with most syndicators, because we're investing in markets that they're no longer investing in or have never invested in. So we follow the data and we jump across the United States. It's very painful to do, because most syndicators invest in one metro or two, and I am currently invested in 17. So it's a different concept. It's a follow the data science concept. I enjoy doing it, and it seems to work for us so far. We have one of the highest IRR-based exit returns in the industry.
Yeah, that's fantastic, Neil. And your portfolio is up to about $947 million, I believe,
that's right,
at this point.
So about 4,800 doors, and that includes both the built buildings and the new construction.
Very good. Well, congrats on all that success. So Neil is obviously somebody who's been in the industry for a while, built a great reputation, and knows knows what he's doing. So let's gain some value from your insights today, Neil. So give us your perspective on just where we are in the market right now. I mean, what are you seeing and what are you taking away from that?
It's a confused market. So on Saturday, I was teaching at a large conference, the MFIN conference, and my co-presenters were, you know, pretty famous people in real estate. Brandon Turner was doing the session right after me, and then before me was Robert Helms of the Real Estate Guys. So they, you know, Robert Helms been doing this for about since the 80s. Brandon Turner, of course, is famous, you know, as BiggerPockets CEO. And so we're talking with both of these people. And so what was interesting to me is that neither one of them knew what I knew that day, right? And they've been in real estate for a long time. I, in my presentation, said, you know, most people here, if I asked you, what is the definition of a US recession? The most common recession is two consecutive quarters of negative growth. Mm-hmm. So we already know that Jan to March was a negative GDP growth quarter. And so I was doing that presentation in you know, last week in mid-July. And when I was doing that, I was saying to people in the room, Q2 GDP is going to come in negative. And they're like, no, we think it's going to come in positive. That, you know, most folks are saying it's going to be positive. The answer is it really can't be positive and it's going to be negative. So they're like, so Neil, are you announcing that we are now in a US recession? The answer is no. And they're like, but two consecutive quarters of GDP growth means a recession. The answer is mm-hmm. no, that's just a common rule of thumb. There is mm-hmm. an organization called the NBER that announces recessions, and they use the two negative GDP quarters as a benchmark. But there's lots of other things that go into it. So this morning, right before I came to this podcast, I did read that GDP growth was negative again in Q2. So negative in Q1, negative in Q2. Most times this would constitute a US recession. And for reasons that you guys are going to find out later, it's not going to happen this time. So it's not we're not in a recession, but we're moving towards one. So at this point, with Q2 GDP being negative, the chances of a recession happening later in the year or next year, that's what I'm betting on, are almost 100%, right? So we are in this very weird environment. It's very confusing, right? And mm-hmm. I'll explain why it's confusing. Today, unemployment is insanely sticky. We are at 3.6%. Last month, 3.6%. The month before, 3.6%. We have mm-hmm. the Fed throwing hand grenades at the real estate economy and the general economy, right? The Fed is gut punching the economy with ridiculously large 0.75% increases, you know, meeting after meeting increases. Normally that you would see immediate weakness in the economy, massive layoffs. And we hear news of layoffs, but hey, look at the unemployment rate. We're at 3.6%. It's almost right. impossible. It's almost impossible for the economy to actually go into a recession when unemployment is this ridiculously low. We've also got incredible household balance sheets. So COVID basically gifted $5.8 trillion, that's $5,800 billion, to the average mm-hmm. American. And so if you look at bank balances of Americans, they are the highest in history, mm-hmm. right? And so when you look at those, and you look at the fact that COVID encouraged people to retire early, so, you know, 4 million Americans retired earlier than they would have otherwise. And as a result, the job market is extraordinarily strong, right? I was walking to the Seattle hotel, and I counted how many for hire signs there were. In 150 yards, there were 17 for hire signs. That doesn't happen in a recession, right? Yeah. Nobody is, and people are not fighting over labor. And right now, everyone's fighting over labor because 11 million unfilled jobs are open. Right. So we're all confused. We're like, what is really happening here? So should we listen to the 3.6% unemployment, which is an amazing rate, and the 11 million unfilled jobs? Or should we listen to the fact that the Fed is basically, you know, throwing hand grenades at the real estate industry? We're in a confusing time, Kent, and that's what everyone's feeling.
Mm-hmm. So give us a path forward through this confusing time. What's the data that you're paying attention to?
So I think that the key messaging that you should know about is this. The economy is ridiculously and extraordinarily strong. It's common for people to say, well, the common man is not feeling that. I don't agree with that. It was okay to say that the common man felt like they were in a recession in 2010, 11, 12, 13, even though the US economy came out of a recession in March 2009. That was right, because most of the benefits that went to people after the Great Recession went to rich people, right? And the banks. So all the money went to the banks, all the benefits went to the rich people. So the poor people still felt like they were recession all the way through to 2013, 2014. No one can say that today, because if you're saying it, you're not being data driven, right? Because last year, the average American, the people at the bottom of the totem pole, got 5% salary increases. Now, of course, with inflation at 9%, that doesn't feel right. My point, though, is it doesn't feel like a recession, logically speaking, equivalent to what we saw in 2009. So people are still in a good place and plenty of jobs are available. Anyone in America of any age today, if they want a job, they've got one. And if they want a full-time job, they've got one. So by those two benchmarks, we're not in a recession. And so as a syndicator, what Kent's asking me is, okay, how do we look at this data? Well, the answer is you look very carefully and you wait, because right now is a time to basically measure to see what happens. And there's two scenarios. And one scenario is not good for us, and one scenario is really bad for us. So there are no great scenarios for multifamily for the next 12 months. And there's some awesome scenarios after that. So let me give you an example of how it could go. So the Fed at this point, yesterday they raised interest rates by 0.75%. Everything that the Fed does has a delay. So what they're doing today will affect the economy 3 months from now, because that's how long it takes for interest rates to wind their way through the economy. It takes 4 to 5 months to close a multifamily deal. So if price is affected, we wouldn't know yet. It takes 3 months to close a single family deal. So if price is affected, we wouldn't know yet, right? So the Fed basically does something and then they wait and measure, right? That's what they're doing right now. And I think really that's what syndicators need to do, to wait and measure. Because we could have two scenarios here. The economy weakens, we start seeing mass layoffs. So if you're in August and September, I would pay the most amount of attention to the unemployment number. That's very key. So if you start seeing, let's say by end of September, you start seeing unemployment numbers that are projecting towards 5%, then we could go into a recession as soon as, October, right? It's possible, right? But I don't think that's going to happen, because the Fed hasn't even managed to move it from 3.6% to 3.7%, despite all the hand grenades they've thrown. And once again, that's because of that $5 trillion of COVID stimulus. It's still sitting in people's banks and it takes a while to spend it. So what you're likely to see is that the economy weakens, but it weakens very, very slowly, and inflation remains high. And so in that scenario, we could A, avoid a recession altogether. So, inflation will weaken over time because of interest rates, but that $5.8 trillion will protect the economy from going into a recession. Well, in that case, no US recessions, but high interest rates, because the Fed has to keep dropping hand grenades to push the unemployment rate up, to push inflation down. And that's what I'm seeing so far. So far, it seems like the Fed's having less impact than they want to. They want it quickly to have impact. They want it quickly to quash inflation. I haven't seen that yet. And so be watching inflation. It doesn't matter if you're a syndicator or if you're the CEO of Apple. Right now, you got to watch just two things. Is inflation going down and is unemployment going up? If you watch those two numbers, you'll have a sense of where the economy is going. Because what people are saying on media, in podcasts, doesn't make any sense to me. They're like, we feel like it's a recession. No one's feeling like it's a recession. Anyone can get a job today. Unemployment is 3.6%. And today, and this is very rare, by the way, in America in the last 30 years. So last time we felt like the workers had control of salaries was in 1999, when the dot-com boom was happening. Since then, it's always been the employers that have had control in terms of, the salary negotiation. That's not the case today. That's not the case today. If you have a good job, if you feel good about your skills, you should be asking your boss for a raise today. Everyone should, right? That's the real situation in the US. There are not enough people in the job market, and employers don't want to lose anybody. So we could have a bizarre situation, Kent, where we actually go to a situation where the economy goes into stagflation, but doesn't go into recession, because employers can't afford to let their employees go, even though their profits are dropping. And we might actually end up in that particular situation. So watch those two numbers: inflation, And unemployment will tell you everything you need to know.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I mean, I think that a couple of things that you pointed out, I mean, one, what 11 million, is that what you said now, open jobs? I mean, that's just something that is...
It's a staggering number, right? I mean, you're happy with five.
And because I think a lot of people don't understand is that the unemployment rate is artificially low because it doesn't include people that aren't looking for work. And a lot of people aren't looking for work. Right. Mm-hmm. I think you said 4 million people left the job market, you know, prematurely, let's say, or they entered retirement early because of COVID. And a lot of those people, you know, aren't coming back, at least not yet. I think people thought
not yet. I think there's
back.
Money. Their money's going to run out in about 2 years. Yeah, they have, you know, they benefited the most from COVID. The older people benefited the most from COVID because they got the most, you know, stimulus. But at some point, their money will run out. So I do expect that in a couple of years, you know, million and a half of those will come back. But I see no evidence of them re-entering the job market, which basically is driving the unemployment rate down and making the Fed's job much harder.
Right. Because, I mean, the Fed is concerned historically about two things, right? Unemployment and inflation. And so they've historically been very focused on unemployment. And now they're focused more on inflation. Because I don't see how the unemployment number really changes. If you have an 11 million gap, and even if your million and a half people come back in, right, that's not a dent. I think.
Well, it will still change, because I think what will simply happen is as companies start seeing the economy slow, you will see unemployment tick up. But normally, if the Fed is throwing this many hand grenades, you started seeing it tick up like very sharply, 3.6, 3.9, you know, 4.2, 4.5. That's what normally happens. But you might see 3.6, 3.7. Well, it's going to take a very long time to get to an actual recession if it's only going up 0.1% a month or less. So I think that it's a very interesting dance that we're going to see. So I think interest rates might be higher longer than most people think. Me, I was predicting interest rates would peak in December. Now I'm thinking, well, it might be actually an extra 3 months there, because it's taking longer for the economy to weaken because it was so strong.
Yeah, and because of a couple of deals that we've done recently and looking at rate caps, I've been hyper-focused on forward curves for interest rates. And, you know, they've gone from the expectation that SOFR, which is just one of the interest rates, but a fairly good representation. And a lot of commercial real estate folks are watching, because a lot of our loans are tied to it. The expectation was it peaks kind of this time next year. I mean, even 2 to 3 months ago. Now it's shifted to the expectation is peaking more in January, December. So the expectation is that interest rates are peaking earlier because of the action that the Fed is taking now.
Right.
But again, those are always just the best guess.
It is a best guess, and it goes backwards and forwards depending upon what, you know, what the economy does, right? So I still believe we're going to see a downward curve in interest rates next year. So if you're buying today, you have to basically use that methodology. So for example, I am not buying fixed rate debt today. I'm buying floating rate debt on my properties that are stabilized, where I have the ability to buy floating rate debt with you know, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or similar loans. I'm buying floating rate debt because it, you know, locking in debt at such high rates makes no sense whatsoever. And one of the key things I like to say to people, and this is a real aha moment, right? So understand this. If you look at the last 61 years, the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates 9 times. So they've had 9 interest raising cycles in the US, okay? And all 9 times, the one thing that was common to those 9 times was sharp up, sharp down. What has never happened before, or at least I should say in modern monetary theory in the last 61 years has not happened, is sharp up, plateau for years, and then down. Anyone that thinks that plateau will happen where rates will stay high for 2 to 3 years simply doesn't understand economics, because the Fed's job is to basically take you to the precipice, to the edge. Fed's job is to punch the economy, get you on your knees, and then help you back up. Don't forget the help you back up part, and they cut rates to do that. So this is what, you know, if you can see what I'm saying, this is what Fed rate hikes look like: sharp up, sharp down. There was one plateau in the last 61 years, and that was in 2007. It was a 9-month plateau where they plateaued at the top. And the current Fed chairman, Jerome Powell, wrote a long article about how that was the stupidest thing the Fed ever did, to sit and wait and watch. Right. And it basically put us into the Great Depression of 2009. Yeah. So this Fed will not wait at the top. They will get to the top. When they see inflation going down, they will cut rates.
Well, and I think that's important for people to understand, because I mean, those rates are really their greatest tool. Right. It's it's the first tool, the thing that they can really start to pull on. And so absolutely right. They push it up, and then the first thing they're going to do is pull them back. I completely agree with you. And so I think the tip about evaluating fixed rate versus variable rate debt right now, I think is great. And it's the same philosophy we're using. And this is not the time to lock in long term on high rates. And it's a time to I think in time with debt, to give yourself flexibility, right? Give yourself flexibility. Don't get stuck in long terms. Give yourself the option to, you know, follow the interest rates up and down and take advantage as they move down. Not that interest rates, I think there's also this expectation falsely that rates will go back to what they were in the last 10 years. And I'd like to hear your thoughts there, but I think that we, from here, we start to normalize and end up in kind of a middle ground where people may have to. I mean, we've been really spoiled, right, in real estate. I mean, I've got a loan on a property, a fixed loan on a property right now at a rate of 2.56%. I don't see that happening in the future. And I think people need to get comfortable in the 5% range, 5.5% with spreads that banks are going to put on. And if deals don't work at that level, then they're probably not the right deals to be doing. So perspective there on kind of where we go and kind of where we normalize.
Yeah. So the first thing is the rates from, you know, June 2020 onwards until the end of 2021, that 18-month time frame was a one-off, right? So those were, money was free for 18 months because we needed to get out of a worldwide pandemic. Money will never be free again. So, right? So those 18 months should never factor into your numbers. If you want to look at normalized rates, look at 2019, and you'll get a sense of where we're going to end up, because that economy is going to resemble our economy whenever we come out of a recession next year or late next year. Now, there's people who are like, we are permanently in a higher interest rate environment. The answer is that's impossible. You're not studying economics. So let me give you one example that will completely shatter that myth. Okay. The Eurozone is larger than the United States in terms of GDP. So, you know, it's 27 or 29 countries, depending upon how you do your math. The Eurozone, even though they have not been really in a recession for the last 9 years, have failed to raise their interest rates at any point in those last 9 years for fear of wrecking their economy. The world economy, and the US, of course, is the most entangled in the world economy. No other economy in the world is as entangled with the US economy as we are. The world economy is so weak that despite 9 years of profits, despite 9 years of economic growth, the Eurozone has only raised their interest rate once, a week ago. And that was only raised because the cost of oil and gas is so insane in the Eurozone that their inflation is way beyond ours.
Right.
I mean, you think we have inflation? Check out what's happening in the Eurozone, right? They've got real inflation. And so, and then they've raised their interest rate once. I think they raised a quarter point or half point. The point is, we are the strongest economy in the world by far right now, both from the perspective of overall strength and demographics. And most people, for God's sake, you've got to listen to Peter Zeihan for an hour, right? If you're in multifamily and you do not understand what Peter Zeihan is saying about the world economy and the impact of demographics, you truly don't know what's going on out there. Every economy in the world is weakening, with China weakening the fastest. Why? Because their demographics are horrible. China is basically aging at a stunning rate, right? If you look at major countries in the world, there are two that have good demographics. One is the United States of America, and the second is India. There's two, right? Everyone else has horrifyingly bad demographics, where there are more old people than young people.
Right.
And in those environments, interest rates do not go up. They go down worldwide. And in individual economies, rates go down. Rates cannot go upwards when the number of people who can hold down jobs is decreasing. So we are in an overall rate decrease environment, and that continues all the way to 2050 when demographics hit rock bottom and start to bounce upwards, right? So long term, there's a push downward on rates. Obviously, in the short term, inflation's high, so we got to push them up. But once we return to norm and inflation returns to norm, which I think is beginning to happen, not quite yet, but beginning to happen, then we get back to where that downward pressure is felt. So I think that 2019 is a wonderful benchmark of what rates would look like in the future. And when you're doing your underwriting, maybe you should just look at 2019 rates. I mean, it's all on the web. You can figure out what rates were in 2019. And they're basically in that 4.5, sometimes 5 range that you talked about.
Yeah. And I think that's a great perspective. It's a good tip. I think, you know, make sure you're underwriting the next 12 to 18 months of what we're going to see in higher rates. But I agree, in that longer term, I think we're going to be in that 5 range. And so I think that's a smart way to approach it. I think that this idea, so tell me, you have conversations with a lot of investors, right? And so all this that we've talked about, and the reason I'm going there is because probably 8 out of 10 investors that I've talked to recently, we spend a lot of time talking about interest rates and a lot of time dispelling myths and some of the things that you've just talked about. So tell us, in the conversations that you're having with investors, is it similar? What are people concerned about? What are some of those myths you're hearing that you're dispelling?
Well, one of the things that I do that I strongly recommend every single syndicator does is don't wait to have those conversations. So what we do is we call our investors into webinars. And those webinars, we spend a lot of effort and time and money. We have beautiful graphics. And feel free to grab those graphics from our website, multifamilyu.com, and create your own webinars. So I think this is a great time to proactively educate your investors. Because what I find is I have more investors than almost anyone in the syndication industry. So we have 850 active investors that are, you know, currently invested. And most syndicators have less than those. But I have less of these discussions because I am constantly doing webinars. So we've done two about the impact of interest rates. We've done one specifically on the impact of the Ukraine war. So since the questions are going to come up anywhere and they're going to prevent your investors from investing in your projects, you might as well address them up front. They really appreciate some candidness. They appreciate that you're looking at this more than they are. They're not dumb enough to think that you have a magic wand, but what they want to do is to make sure that their syndicator, their preferred syndicator, is looking at this much more closely than they are, because you're in charge of protecting their wealth, right? So when they see that and you keep doing it again and again, it actually massively increases their confidence. I know, just as an example, since October, when interest rates started spiking and the bad news started happening, my group has raised $150 million from investors, more than half of that for new construction projects, which are considered riskier. Right. Why? Because my investors know I'm watching, right? And they know that I'm watching more carefully than any of them. So the key is, have your one-on-one conversations, but don't wait for them. Have webinars, invite your investors, show them what's happening in the marketplace. They're going to feel really good about it.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. That's fantastic advice. Be proactive in your communication, right? I mean, I think communication is, I mean, without that, then there is just idea and people are left to wonder. And if you can help shape the narrative and provide facts and information, then you can give people that level of comfort, right?
Absolutely. And I think the obviously, right now is a problematic time. So the one question that I really haven't answered for you, Kent, today is, you know, should you be buying multifamily, right? You asked me that up front. And the answer is maybe. It's that, you know, I don't have a straight answer on that one. I think it's very problematic at the moment to buy multifamily because you're so upside down. Your DSCRs are so narrow, so challenging. Mm-hmm. So the answer is I would buy less. I would buy what I needed to get by. Obviously, we've got people on our payroll, we've got underwriters, so I would buy a little bit less because I think that there's more opportunity coming down the line. One thing I can tell you is, at the end of Q2, I just saw RealPage statistics because one of the presenters at the Seattle conference was the director of research at RealPage. Mm-hmm. RealPage says, as of the end of Q2, cap rates in the US for multifamily have not fallen. Sorry,
Right.
not increased. So they're at the
Right.
same level they were in Q1, though they
Right.
clearly appear to have flattened out, which basically means that they will fall in Q3. What he's saying is, look, it takes a long time to close properties. Then it takes a while for that to show up in our numbers. So, we think prices are falling for multifamily. We just don't see any evidence of it in Q2. We have to wait until Q3. So the market actually has no data on how much prices are actually falling for multifamily for another 3 months. Because we got nothing out of Q2. So right now, wait and watch so you know how much prices are falling. But if they're not falling, you're in the wrong market. They absolutely have to fall compared to what they were in January.
I mean, personally, are you experiencing, and I don't know, I know that you partner with a lot of operators, but so I don't know how in the negotiations you are, but are you seeing a softening personally? Are you seeing less people coming to the table? Are you seeing prices trade for like per door below
So
what we've seen?
retrading has started in the last month. So we are now seeing retrading happening where deals that were in contract are not able to be closed. So the buyer seller now has to decide whether he wants to walk away and start over again or retrade. So we are now seeing a lot more retrades happening. RealPage also pointed to the fact that retrades are up maybe 2x, 3x from where they were 4 months ago. So that's the first retrades are usually the first impact of softening. Retrades have to happen before the brokers start telling the buyers, the
Adjusting
sellers, that they got
expectations.
to adjust expectations. So the answer is not yet, but we are in the middle of that process happening. I believe today multifamily is overpriced, and if you can wait for 3 or 4 months, you will get a better price. Remember, I'm not predicting that prices are going to crash. I'm not predicting that they're going to go down and stay down. What I'm predicting is a downward, sharp downward curve, and you're going to see that in Q3. Like, for example, everyone sees these cap rate charts where for years cap rates have been coming down and you see quarter after quarter. Now you're going to see a blip in Q3 of this year. You're going to see a sharp downward movement and then a little bit further down in Q4, and then it'll plateau. And then it'll make its way back up, but it won't be a sharp up. It'll take a number of quarters for rates to finally adjust, start falling, for people to mentally adjust to that. And I think that 18 to 24 months from now, we end up with cap rates back where they were in January. So we still end up at,
When
those the all-time
you
lows.
say a blip, you mean an increase in cap rates,
An
not a
increase, sorry, yeah, a
decrease.
blip upward,
Right.
sorry, an
A blip
upward blip,
up.
which is an increase in cap rates, a decrease in price. From what I can sense, 90% of that decrease, whatever it is, 5%, 10%, 15%, is ahead of us. It hasn't happened yet because it takes an entire quarter of retrading for the broker industry to change the way that they address their clients. And we haven't had that entire quarter happen yet. We've had a month. July was a pretty bad month where there was just a lot of brokers coming back and talking to us about, hey, we got to restart this process, right? So that's just happened. 1 month's not enough. So price declines are ahead of us.
Yeah, I agree with you. I definitely agree with you. I mean, we're seeing it on a more micro level. I mean, we operate in the Midwest where we've been a little more insulated because,
Yeah, you're more
our cap
insulated for
rates are
sure.
just higher,
Yeah,
right?
yeah.
So, well, I mean, we've actually been experiencing rent growth where most of the nation has. In the Midwest, I think it's a little different where we're actually closing at higher cap rates than when we went under contract because we've seen rent grow so much.
Right.
There's a
You're
little
seeing,
more.
you're seeing built-in rent growth, built-in, cap rates simply because rent growth, which, wasn't very strong in the Midwest, is pretty strong right now.
Yeah, I mean Cincinnati, which is has been a very sleepy market historically. I just saw a study that's saying the rent had grown 28% year to date,
Stunning. That's amazing,
which
right?
is
What
pretty
an opportunity.
wild.
I'm not a fan of Cincinnati. Missed out on that one.
Well, but I mean, there's opportunities everywhere, right? It's just different kind of by market. But my whole point was being even in the Midwest, where it's been more of a steady cap rate environment, steady price increases. I mean, we're seeing the same thing. We're seeing less people coming to the table on the buyer side, when we're less competition. But we haven't seen that adjustment really from sellers yet. Same thing. Where we're
No.
seeing sellers still wanting to hold to cap rates of 6 months ago. And so I the whole reason I say this is in agreeing with you that I think that we do start to see some of that softening. And I think that there are going to be some great buying opportunities over the next year.
Yes.
And I think that's where it's so important to be clear on the data to so that you're not operating out of FUD, right? The fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and sitting on the sidelines, and you're operating out of data. And because I think those that can operate with true data and understand the opportunities are going to have some great opportunities over the next 12, 18 months to come in and purchase ahead of, like you said, cap rates beginning, interest rates falling and cap rates continuing after the blip to work their way downwards. Because I think it goes back to, if you go back to supply and demand, right, which I know you're a big fan of, I am as well. We still have an unbalanced supply and demand dynamic. And we still have trillions of dollars sitting on the sidelines that are going to have to be deployed. And some of that is going to be deployed into real estate. I heard an economist, Peter Lindman, he was talking about how, you know, okay, well, the Fed bought $5 trillion in vanilla, right? He was using an ice cream metaphor. He said, it's not that companies and people are going to buy, you know, they're going to trade in for $5 trillion of vanilla. They're going to trade in for vanilla and chocolate and mint chocolate chip, pistachio, whatever, meaning it's going to flow into stocks and real estate and different asset classes. But the whole point being that there's more money than ever before sitting on the sidelines that is going to be deployed, right? And there's still a supply and demand dynamic that's going to drive, I think, long-term price appreciation. I think it's about navigating through the next 12 to 24 months and using good data to make judgments in that time.
I think so. And I want to give you one other piece of data on why prices haven't fallen yet, right? So if you did a 1031 deal where you 1031 out of your property, and a lot of people have done that. I'm addicted to this whole concept of 1031 your syndication out and move it into the next one. I have lots of money and that money has to be deployed. Otherwise I lose my tax benefits. And I have, you know, Taxifornia investors who all pay 40% in tax. So they're like, close, Neil, close. Right. So luckily, I have no such deals right now. So I'm talking about a theoretical one. But if I was in that deal and if I had a lot of Taxifornia investors, they wouldn't care about how much the market was going to fall. They would close on their property. So until we get past that wave of 1031 flips that are happening from ridiculously high prices in Q1 and Q4, and even to some extent Q2, until that wave dies down, the buyers are irrational. They will close even though they shouldn't be, even though they should be retrading, but they're afraid of losing 1031 benefits. So they'll close anyway and they're overpaying for those properties. So it takes time for the market to adjust. And what, you know, my biggest message is, you know, real estate moves very, very slowly. Even, you know, even single family real estate, we're only beginning to see slight price adjustments in the super hot market. So I've seen price adjustments in the last week in Austin, Phoenix, Boise, Tacoma. You know, these are markets that are super duper hot, and I'm beginning to see some happen in Denver as well now. So I'm thinking Miami is going to be next. These are ultra hot markets. Some of them I invest in. I love these markets, but now finally we're seeing prices adjust there. So it takes a while. You're in a long game right now. Don't make your decisions based on what happened last week. You're on a moving train and each month is going to be different. There's also something I want to offer. You know, I've been giving you the positive sides of this, but here's something negative. So there are two things the Fed is doing. Everyone focuses on one of them, interest rate increases. The second is that the Fed is withdrawing liquidity from the marketplace. Today, in June, they withdrew just $15 billion. In September, they plan to withdraw $90 billion. When they withdraw $90 billion of liquidity from the market, that means they're not buying $90 million of our loans, which means that the private market, the commercial market, has to buy those loans. And the commercial market historically charges a lot more than you know, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac do. So as they reduce liquidity and they do not buy these bonds that they're buying today, that will affect liquidity in the entire market, in the stock market, in the bond market, in the real estate market. And you're going to start seeing the impacts of that very strongly in September. Now, I do not believe that they will withdraw $5 trillion of liquidity because the Fed's track record of withdrawing money sucks. You know, they printed $4 trillion in 2008, 2009, 2010, and they only withdrew 10% of that in the last 9 years. but they will withdraw some of it to slow the economy down. And that will hurt us because we need loans. Loans equals liquidity, and the Fed is going to pull $90 billion of liquidity out per month.
So just continue that. So when you say there's going to be impacts from them pulling liquidity out, what are those impacts that people should look for or expect?
So I think what happens is that when liquidity in the marketplace is reduced, it reduces the number of lending options, and it also reduces the amount of money that those people can lend. So, you know, we look at Fannie Mae as a lender. We look at Freddie Mac. We look at LifeGoes. We look at all of these companies, right? They need liquidity. So when liquidity reduces, those people reduce the amount of lending they offer. So you'll basically have less loans available. And when less loans are available, the price goes up.
Right. It's going to increase the cost of capital. It's going to, I mean, if there's less money to give out, they're going to be more selective on who they give it to, and they're going to increase their spreads on that money.
They can increase their spreads, right? Yeah, they want to make money, right? So
yeah. So that's where like just to kind of bring it back for folks. So you have, first we were talking about them adjusting interest rates, right? And that's that benchmark rate that kind of sits down here. But when you go and get a loan, that bank or organization puts a spread on top of that, right? So what you're actually paying is up here. You're paying that benchmark plus that bank's spread. So they're increasing and moving the benchmark up and down. What Neil is saying is as they pull out liquidity, then typically what happens is that spread also starts to increase. So you have both of these increasing. And that's why I think that's longer term why neither of us seem to think the interest rates are going to go back and we're going to be able to get that 2.5% fixed rate loan like I was able to get in 2020, right? It's going to be more in the 4 to 5% range. And so just to kind of bring the picture back for folks, I think that's a good way to understand. Well, Neil, man, you've hit us with so much value. I appreciate how you're cutting through a lot of the emotional headlines and getting to some of the facts. I think there's always tremendous value in that. I always appreciate you coming on. Before I let you go, I do want to take you through our Keys to Success round. And I've got four questions I want to ask you.
Sure.
The first one is, if you were to invest in someone else's deal, which I believe this is right up your alley, and you could only ask them one question, what would that one question be?
Well, it varies, but today I think it would be what's the DSCR in your deal, which is we have never done this before, but in today's environment, the DSCR, if you don't know what that is, look it up, is all really that matters to me when I'm investing, the spread.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. I think that's a great answer for the times that we are in, because if you can pay your mortgage, you can live to fight another day. And I think that's what we're trying to do right now over the next 24 months is you live to fight another day. And what are you most proud of in your career?
Transparency. I think that I'm pretty good at just telling people the things that the way that they are. And I haven't really given an F about what that means for my investor database. And I've been surprised by how much that has actually led to my investor database growing, even though I often tell people bad news.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're only delivering the good news, then people are going to be surprised by the bad. And I think you never want to be surprised, right? You want to be, news is news, good or bad, it has to be delivered. Awesome. What is a book that everybody should read?
Definitely The Miracle Morning. It may not be the best book in the world, but if you read the book and follow what it says, you will find your best book.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I love that book, and I think it's an amazing process to start your day right. And last but not least, what is your number one key to success?
Data beats gut feel by a million miles. I say that to me as myself every day. Because what I find is that there's a tendency as we get, you know, better in our business to start believing that our gut feel somehow is magically better than data. I'm not exempt from this. I have regretted making gut feel based decisions and they haven't worked out for me. So I, you know, key to my success is I keep forcing myself to say this: data beats gut feel by a million miles.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic advice. So Neil, thank you so much for coming on the show. I know you have a lot of resources for folks. If folks want to learn more about what you're doing, your business, where can they reach you?
I think the best place to go is multifamilyu.com. That's multifamily followed by the letter u.com. We publish about 20 webinars. About 30,000 people watch these webinars each year. They're on different topics right now, as you can imagine, the impact of the Ukraine war, interest rates impacts and several other items like that, how prop tech is impacting what we're doing in real estate. Those are the most recent webinars, so check those out. That's probably the best way to start interacting with us.
Awesome. Well, thank you for those resources. We'll share those below so people can access them. And Neil, I hope you have a great rest of the day.
Thanks so much, Kent. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to another great episode of Ritter on Real Estate. Hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss out on the content that will make you a better investor. Also, visit kentritter.com for articles, videos, and tools curated just for passive investors. Until next time, this is Kent Ritter with Ritter on Real Estate. Now go out and invest like a pro.